Hello and welcome to the Gentleman's Journal podcast, a fortnightly discussion all about success, modern business and the lives of entrepreneurs. I'm Joe Bullmore, I'll be your host for the day, and I'm joined this afternoon by Sir Paul Smith. One of the most successful men's fashion designers in the world and a titan of British industry, Paul's career began after a bike crash as a teenager. His rise in the world of fashion was slow and steady, but ultimately unstoppable. From a tiny shop in Nottingham, Paul now operates over 300 stores worldwide, each with their own unique personality, and still oversees every single area of the business himself. For today's episode, I met Paul in his remarkable office in Covent Garden. It's an overflowing museum of collectibles, bizarre trinkets, and priceless works of art. With that as our backdrop, Paul tells us about his bespoke by appointment service, why the most dangerous thing you can do is to follow trends, and what to do if you ever receive a live pigeon in the post. Paul, thanks very much for joining us on the Gentleman's Journal podcast.
Nice to be here.
It's all right. Well, we're with you. We're in your office.
Yeah, we're in, full of bicycles and books and objects.
So you get sent these bicycles for free. Obviously a podcast isn't the best thing to review the contents of a room, but what we're looking at is dozens of colourful bicycles from all over the world, kind of India, Lithuania, and from a lot of famous cyclists. But, do you still cycle regularly?
Yeah, my dream as a teenager was to be a racing cyclist, and after a crash, I ended up doing this, the day job, which is called fashion.
Absolutely.
And I do, I've got a bike, which I ride, sadly, not as much as I would like to do because of a busy schedule.
And the London commute, it's not very
safe. I have a home, luckily, in Italy, and I keep a... I've got one of Brad Wiggins' old bikes in Italy, so I use that one, and that's when I really have the opportunity to ride a bike when I'm on holiday in the summer.
Yeah, so it's quite an incredible story for anyone that doesn't know. The way you got into fashion was almost accidental entirely.
Literally, I fell into fashion. Crash! I was a bike rider from the age of 12 until 18, and then. My dream was to be, do it for a living, and then Carr and I had an argument. The car won, and after 3 months in hospital, I discovered the English pub, and luckily the pub I discovered was where all the art students went. That was the students of fashion, photography, architecture, graphic design, and so my world, changed into. The world of creativity, which was, wonderful.
So it was never a deliberate thing. It was kind of just
by osmosis. Not at all. My passion was bike riding. But I think I was relatively smartly dressed. But I wasn't a real sort of clothes horse or anything.
Right.
But I was only 18 when I had the crash. So I suppose a lot of young people are not that interested in anything particular up until 16, 17, 18, and then it's things start to change. So I became just more conscious of creativity, and then at the age of 19, helped somebody start a shop, and then I got into fashion that way. And then at the age of 21, I met Pauline, who became my girlfriend, now my wife, and she was the one that really got me into the world of making clothes, because she studied fashion at the Royal College of Art, and the fashion she studied was couture fashion.
Okay, so
that
proper.
That means making it by hand to fit the body.
Yeah,
and basically that's for women, but for men it's bespoke.
Yeah. So what was the first piece of clothing you ever made? Do you remember?
The piece of clothing I probably made was, because Pauline made most of the original Paul Smith items. The one I made was shirts. I used to make shirts for a company in London. I was based in Nottingham at the time, and there was a company called the Chelsea Cobbler, who made bespoke shoes, and they wanted to have some shirts in their shop just to go along with you know, the shoes they sold. So I remember making those and being frightened with this thing called a buttonholer, and a it was so scary because I had a big knife that came down to cut the button hole, and working that for the first time was pretty hair raising.
And did you call them Paul Smith? Were you saying these are Paul Smith shirts?
No, they were called Chelsea Cobbler shirts.
Oh, okay.
And then we started, Paulie and I started our own little shop when I was 21. So then we did have some Paul Smith items.
So it was very kind of accidental, as we say, a very slow, gradual, comfortable falling into this world of fashion.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that's probably why I'm still doing okay, you know, and still here, because at some point I've actually done most of the jobs myself.
So yeah.
I used to call it training by doing it, you know,
yeah.
And so I learnt my skill from my wife, who was at the Royal College of Art. I went to night school to learn about bespoke tailoring, as well as being taught by Pauline. The interesting thing about that was the tailor that taught me, I think it used to be called City and Guilds, I don't know whether it still exists, it's like a night school.
Yeah.
And the tailor that taught me was a military tailor.
Wow.
And what that meant was he was the ceremonial dress tailor.
So very sharp.
Yeah, the guys you see at Trooping of the Colour outside Buckingham Palace. And of course, the interesting thing about tailoring for ceremonial, it's very much about making the person look important and have good posture.
Yeah.
So it's very much about how you cut the clothes, how you actually the pads use in the shoulder, the type of stitching you use on the chest. So it was brilliant learning curve.
Yeah.
So the combination of Pauline, which was very much about quality, understanding cloth, and then the military one was a good training.
Yeah. So you had some tailoring experience, but you didn't really have any kind of business experience.
No.
At all.
I mean, I left school at 15.
Yeah.
Because of my cycling, love of cycling. And then started my own shop when I was 21 with, you know, a few £100 worth of savings.
Yeah.
And the thing is that I never had any formal fashion training or formal business training. So
did you ask for advice from people? Did you ask for help? Did you go to kind of older businessmen and say,
no,
how do I run a shop?
No. The only thing I did do was that some friends similar age to me, one was a solicitor and then one was a trainee accountant.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you should get this book called a Simplex system book, which meant you had to be simple to use it. So it was perfect for me. It was a very basic accountancy book called a Simplex system. And all you did was really put in, you know, the basics, how much your rent was and how much you spent on this, that and the other, and you hoped that it might be a fraction of profit at the end of the year, which there normally was a very small amount, but somehow it worked anyway. And I was, I'm not being over modest when I say this, but I think I've done okay because I'm okay at business and I'm okay at design, rather than exceptionally, you know, one or rather than the other. I mean, I think that's just having to do it yourself has really helped, because you've packed the boxes, you've written the invoice, you've ordered the fabric, you've done the selling. So at some point you've experienced the things that I have about 1,400 staff now, and I've at some point done some form of aspect of their job.
Yeah.
And so our business was built very gently and very, very slowly, doing a little bit better each year, but never worrying about it because we were very happy.
Was the 1960s people assume it's a very creative time. Was it very creative? Did you know lots of musicians? Was there kind of lots of different influences around?
When you're a teenager, I mean, it's just a lovely time, hopefully, because you're experiencing first girlfriend, first gig, first university, new experience, new experience, new experience. Whereas But the thing about the 1960s, in my opinion, it might not be correct, but it was the second generation after the war, after the horror of being deprived of many things, being very frightened and living a very nervous sort of existence. And suddenly you sort of looked around and you could do more. You could be yourself. You had a little bit of opportunity. You had some money. People were doing things that were different. So you got bands coming along with, like the Stones or the Beatles, and later on Led Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, and very progressive music in terms of music, graphic design. People like a guy called Alan Aldrich, who did all this sort of a lot of the artwork for the Beatles.
Yeah.
And I think the thing is that it was just a time. The 60s was just a time that was very full of yes, of course you can do it. Why not? Let's try. Let's have a go. And it was, and in fashion, it was actually quite an extreme period, and especially to the latter part of the 60s, which was, you know, long hair.
Was that your look? Did you have long hair?
I mean, I think most young people, you know, were influenced by the bands at the time. And also there was a strong link between Los Angeles, San Francisco and London in terms of music. Mm. So you had Laurel Canyon in Los Angeles, and then you had Hyte and Ashbury, or the whole hippie area of San Francisco. And, you know, boys look like a lot more feminine than they would today. And then later on, you got movies like Performance with Mick Jagger and wearing makeup. And it was just, and what was lovely about it, it was just all right. It wasn't aggressive. It wasn't about burning cars or killing people. It was just self-expression through wanting to look different to your older brother or your parents. And it was just a loosening of you just being able to relax a little bit more.
Do you miss those kind of young, uncertain, adventurous days? Now you've got 1,500 members of staff or so, and you've got shops.
I mean, I'm blessed with being, you know, Portsmouth is an independent company.
Yeah.
I'm still the boss, so, you know, we're surrounded in this, the official boardroom with 17 bicycles, and I can see a rabbit mask, a monkey mask, lots of objects. So, I mean, I'm just blessed with being able to still be myself, and the adventures are still there. I mean, not the same adventures, but they're still there. You know, I travel the world most weeks of my life, and I'm very blessed with being able to make the decisions myself and being quite spontaneous.
Yeah.
I would say that sadly the world is not so spontaneous as it was before. And I think especially younger generation are a lot more considered, because as we said earlier, there's a lot of comparison you can make all the time. Well, my career path should be following this, or my appearance should be this, or my group that I'm with should be like this, or and so there's a lot more. It's a lot more to consider now, whereas when I was starting out, there was very little to consider, because there weren't clothes shops across the whole country, or there's not the internet. So it's just a very different way. I mean, it doesn't mean that one's better than or one's worse. It was just different.
Do you think there's a danger, as all these formerly independent houses come under these big umbrellas, that they're losing some of that independence and spontaneity?
Yes, I mean, I think it depends on what your priorities are. Suddenly, we had a group of people here yesterday, and one of the gentlemen said, oh, you know, have you considered selling to some of the bigger companies? And I said, not at all. And he said, well, why not? You'd get a load of money. And I said, well, if that's the priority, yes, I would. But I'm comfortable and I'm happy and I'm healthy. And, you know, it depends on what your priorities are. You know, for me, I'd just sooner be able to, you know, paint a building pink or slide down the banister without asking anybody. Is this correct for the brand image? You know,
You speak about your pink buildings and stuff and all your floor spaces and all your amazing spaces you've got everywhere. Paul Smith is quite unique again in that you own all of them, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, well, this building we're sitting in, we own, and we own our New York building, Milan building, five warehouses in my hometown, and the ones in Mayfair. So over the years, rather than needing or wanting or having private jets, chauffeur-driven cars, or anything like that, I'm happy to have my bike.
Okay.
As we've made a bit of money, we've been somehow wise enough to invest in, well, where Westbourne House is, where the Bespoke is, for instance. We own that building. And it's just, I think I'm just old-fashioned, really.
Yeah.
You know, I might remember my father always saying, it's good to own something if you can, you know. So I think that's what happens.
And the Bespoke by appointment service out of the Westbourne House, which is in West London.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Westbourne House is an old house. And I think there's something charming about the fact that you can have, you can order handmade clothes out of a house in Notting Hill in London. I've enjoyed Bespoke clothes. My first suit I got Bespoke was mint green double-breasted.
Wow.
When I was 18.
Have you still got that somewhere?
No.
Oh,
I don't think so. Probably my wife threw it out many years ago. I've always been fascinated by handmade clothes.
Okay.
And I used to hang out with a tailor in Nottingham and watch him cut and watch him make the patterns and watch him stitch. And it's always been something I've really been, you know, really enjoyed. And my dream was always to have a Bespoke room. And that's something that we now have. The suits are about £3,000 upwards. So it's quite a costly thing, but it's a really delightful thing to, if nobody's had a Bespoke suit, it's a really lovely thing to do. We've got this enormous selection of fabrics. You can choose your own lining, you could choose your own buttons, your own buttonholes. It's just a very fascinating thing to do.
Do people get very experimental with it?
No, we've got one or two customers that are very experimental. It's very good if you are for instance, very tall, or you find it difficult to get things off the peg. But otherwise, it's just a nice thing. And the great thing about hand-stitched clothes is that there will always be a small imperfection. So when you have got hand-stitched lapel, or the sleeve in is put in by hand, you're very reliant on the tightness of the stitch from the tailor. And that little imperfection is just such a beautiful sign that it's made by hand. I think Bespoke has never been more delightful, because you can get anything anywhere at every level. And the one thing that's great is if it's a cabinet made out of wood by a carpenter by hand just for you, or a particular pair of shoes that are made specially for you.
Yeah.
And then obviously for a suit, it's the thing that you wear in many cases. If you're a businessman, you wear every day. And so it's just a very beautiful thing. You know, a handmade suit is really different, especially the armholes. If the sleeve has been put in by hand, you'll get a lot more movement when you're leaning forward, when you're stretching. So it's a very comfortable thing.
Do you still get your hands dirty? Are you still tailoring?
I probably could still create one, but not anymore. But we've got two very good cutters, both trained on Savile Row.
Yeah.
The clothes are made in London, and you know they're real experts at their job.
We've spoken about the office. I mean, that is probably the most eclectic place in the entire Paul Smith portfolio.
Yeah.
How did it start, this kind of accidental hoarding where people are sending you all this stuff?
I mean, that's a question that many people ask all the time, and I have very lovely visitors here, one of them being Jonathan Ive from Apple, and he's been a pal of mine since before he actually joined Apple. But when he comes, he stands in and said, how did this start? And neither of us can answer that question. And it's just the fact that people think they can send a letter or an object something to me, and they know that it will be enjoyed or appreciated. And what's lovely is they're never, it's never about demands.
It's so never tit for tat. They're never asking for something.
No, I mean, they don't say, I'm sending you this because I want a job. I mean, a lot of things just come, and we had 700 assorted old mobile phones arrive in a box saying, I know Paul Smith likes things.
anything.
Yeah.
What do you do with 700 old phones?
We've just decorated an entire wall in a new shop in Paris with them.
Okay,
and,
wow.
And that's caused fantastic interest, because people come into the shop and really enjoy it. Oh, I used to have one of those. Oh no, isn't that lovely? I remember my first one that you open up. And
are they kind of the last 30 years? Are they really old ones, or are they,
well, I mean, modern ones? I'm not an expert on that, but there was, you know, a lot of the ones that used to open up rather than just flat ones.
So they're quite visually nice. They're not just going.
Yeah, and they're all attached to the wall, one wall.
Lovely.
So it looks really good.
So you're not surprised anymore by anything that comes through the post?
Not at all, because we have Kirsty, who works with me for many years. She's so used to madness and so laid back that we had a call from reception saying that there's a live pigeon arrived for Paul, and she said, that's not in the schedule, rather than, what, a live pigeon? And I thought that sort of summed up their building, actually. And the things that are behind me here, these, like a rabbit with a stamps on it. And now, I'm not sure if you know about that story, but that's an unknown admirer or fan that for over 40 years, unknown, 40 wow. years, has been sending things like a skateboard, a ski, a chair, a football, a hat, a peace sign, a plastic birthday cake on my birthday. And first of all, there's no note. They're always from the same handwriting. And the key thing is that they arrive and they're never in a box.
Okay, so they are the kind of packaging.
They literally arrive as you see them. And we had the postman one day arrived with a large Austrian cowbell round his neck going dong, dong, dong as they walked in the door. And that was one with the stamps and the address actually on the cowbell.
Incredible.
Not in a box.
Well, we must find out who that is. Would you like to know?
No, absolutely. Don't want to know. No.
It might be someone very close to you who's been pranking you for all these years.
Well, they come from America.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
And we've had the BBC, we've had all sorts of people saying, oh, can we try and track this person down? I say, oh, no, why? It's lovely because there's no demand.
And I've heard you say before that you kind of get inspiration from these different random things that
come in.
Yeah,
of course, because, I mean, the room where we are and the room next door is just full of things which have no monetary value or are very valuable, or they're very bad taste or very beautiful taste, and small things, big things, rough things, smooth things. And they, of course, they can be absolutely inspirational in any way. I mean, just you could think, oh, well, a really kitsch print on a T-shirt, but with a cashmere suit or something like that, you know.
If it's kind of Monday morning and on the first day when you know you've got to design a new collection and you get in at 7 a.m. or something, probably earlier.
Six,
quite right. What do you do at that time? What's your first thing? What's step one?
Well, normally the first thing I do is be pleased that I'm just on my own and I can just get myself my day organised, because I will have already had a list from Kirsty about what the day...
Yeah.
What's happening, like today, I knew I was doing this. So you get your head around your day and prepare for your day. We often ring Japan because they're 9 hours ahead, and I have an office in Japan and 260 shops in Japan. So there's normally something to talk about there. And then if I've got a design meeting, I'll probably trawl through a lot of my books just for... I mean, if it's a design meeting about colour, or if it's a design meeting about a particular, what do we have a certain theme in mind? Or, but I will have already have this, the notebooks which I'm now showing the microphone. I will already have things in mind that I will have thought of 2 weeks ago, yesterday.
And then it's just kind of little notes saying...
Yeah, and then I will collate them together. So there'll be, it might say, you know, butterfly wings, and that will mean something to me. It will mean the iridescent colour of a butterfly's wing, and that might turn into a mercerised cotton for a piece of knitwear. You know, so it could be anything, and I've got a very lateral way of thinking about things, and I'm quite blessed with having good eyes.
Yeah.
Over here, on the left of the microphone, are a big pile of photographs from my father, who was an amateur photographer.
Yeah.
And so he was the founder member of the local camera club in the town where we lived, outside of Nottingham. And then, of course, it was not digital. It was developing and printing with film, and you had to have a dark room. And so at the age of 11 onwards, I got given a camera by my dad, and I started taking photographs, and used to develop and print photographs with my dad in the attic of the house. He built a dark room. And the interesting thing about photography, especially then, is you had to look through a viewfinder, so like a small square, and you really had to consider what you were looking at and the composition of what you were looking at. And I think that over the years has trained my eyes to look and see rather than just look. And so that helps me a lot with my design work, because I'll look at a wall and I'll see texture, or I'll see graffiti, or I'll see shadows, and that could turn into a influence to for a print or a fabric or whatever.
So there are ideas coming in kind of all...
I mean, the least of the problem, honestly, and I'm not being at all silly when I say this, but the least of the ideas are... At least of the problem are ideas.
So there's never a kind of writer's block?
Not at all. No, the hardest thing is just, as you know, and you know, many people know who are listening, hopefully, is, you know, just existing and building a business and getting around in today's world is far more complicated than it used to be. And the actual creative side, to be honest, is the easy bit. It's the turning the ideas into reality and then keeping that going.
Yeah.
Often people ask me about the thing I'm most proud of, and I would always answer continuity, because we've been doing fine for a long time. And so many people do the Andy Warhol 15 minutes and then sadly fall by the wayside. But at least we've been doing okay for a while.
But do you ever have moments of kind of doubt and think, oh, maybe we've gone slightly wrong with this collection?
I mean, over the years, I've had 2 or 3, 4 times where there's a very strong thing happening in, let's say, fashion.
Yeah.
But it could be anything. It could be shop design, or it could be graphic design or something, where things have suddenly changed dramatically. Like, it, let's say everything's gone very minimal, or everything's gone very decorative, and in fact both of those things have happened recently with fashion, for instance.
Right
now there's a lot of ornamentation, decoration,
the kind of pattern. Gucci,
and then previously they would have the more minimal effects of the Japanese designers. So you question, oh, should I be doing this? Should I be doing that? Should I? And then nearly always, hopefully, you always come back to say, well, no, I am what I am.
Yeah.
So what people want from me is what's been overused, but the classic with a twist. You know, it's just the fact that you can wear Paul Smith clothes, but there's always a little sense of humour, a little hidden detail in the lining, or an unusual pattern, or just the way you put things together.
Yeah, and people often say, don't they, with a Paul Smith suit, that it's either their first suit or the suit they get married in.
Yes,
is that true?
It's amazing that's probably the main thing that people tell me when I travel the world. They see me at an airport or something. I got married in one of your suits.
Yeah.
I mean, and actually, I can't name any names, but quite a lot of famous people now. Well, they weren't famous then, but now they say, I got married in one of your suits. And now they're, you know, pretty important actor or musician or something, which is lovely. I had one friend We one of our shops in Covent Garden, in the basement is where we sell all the suits, and there's three changing rooms down there and a mirror at the end of the changing rooms.
Yeah.
And one of my pals, this is years ago now, one of my pals, 17-year-old son, wanted to get a suit for university. So he went and he said, I want a Paul Smith suit. So he went and tried the suit on, and he came out of the change room and turned left to look in the mirror. And at that point, somebody else came out of the other changing room further down and looked at him and said, oh, you look cool, man. And it was David Bowie. And my friend's wow. son nearly, he just like went completely white.
Oh, my
and
God.
Then lost his voice. And
I bet he bought that suit then.
He bought the suit and he will never forget it. I think he still downs out on that yeah. on that story. Yeah.
So I'm interested in hearing your point of view on the changing kind of culture and fashion right now, and as things go more and more digital and towards the internet, what are the biggest kind of threats, especially to menswear?
Well, I mean, just the first of all, I mean, I've been around for a long time, and you know, when I started my career, the average man had no interest in fashion, and certainly the average man never used moisturizer yeah. or body care, or they had hair, but
yeah,
in which they pushed their hands through their fingers through, you know. But I mean, now it's changed so immensely that people are a lot more conscious. Even if you only wear a t-shirt and jeans, you'd be a lot more conscious what they are. But the main thing probably is fast fashion, really. The fact they never used to be low cost,
yeah,
fast fashion, that didn't exist, and now there's so much of that, and there's so much available online as well. Of course, the internet never existed, and now our biggest shop by far is the e-com. So it's meant that with shops, you have to keep your shops looking really, really interesting, really special, which is really played into our hands at Paul Smith, because our shops are so very, very special.
We always end every interview with these slightly more personal, interesting questions. Mm. So you have to be as honest and immediate as you can. Who in the world of business do you most admire?
Business. Somebody like Jonathan Ive from Apple, because, you know, he stuck by his guns and he did things which were very simple, and doing things which are less is quite hard sometimes. Doing less.
Yeah. What's your most treasured physical possession? This one will be difficult.
Oh, that is very difficult.
If you have to pick one other thing in this huge
can I come
museum?
Back with a list of 450,000, please? I mean, it would almost certainly be photo albums.
Okay.
Yeah, family photo albums.
Yeah.
Because that's something you can't really replace.
Do you have a favourite piece of clothing?
I've got some shoes that are 40 years old.
Did you make them all?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, wow. And they're still going?
Yeah.
How many times have you resold them?
Probably about 4.
Oh, really?
Mm.
10 years ago. That's
yeah, they're very
good.
They're very very robust. I won't tell you what they're made out of, but
okay.
They're very tough.
Do you have a personal motto in business or in life?
Never assume that it's being done. Always check that it's being done. Always check your flight. Always check whether the fabric's
yeah.
when the fabric's arriving. Always check that the arrangements for supper are what you think they are. Always check you've booked a taxi.
Okay.
And never assume that you're doing okay. Just make sure you are.
Yeah. And finally, what's your idea of happiness?
Every day is a new beginning. If you've had a day which is not so good today, tomorrow's always a new start. So luckily, every day's all right, so don't know why I've said that.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you very much, Paul, for speaking to us.
Well, very welcome.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Gentleman's Journal podcast. We'll be back in a fortnight with more invaluable insights from the worlds of entrepreneurs, raconteurs and tastemakers. But in the meantime, you can read more at thegentlemansjournal.com or follow us on Instagram if you're so inclined, @thegentsjournal. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you very, very soon.